I'm reading for Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible, pages 109 to 112. This passage comes at the very beginning of Book 2, The Revelation, and is from the point of view of the mother, Orleana Price. Orleana is reflecting on the family's time in the Congo from her current location of Sanderling Island, Georgia. Everything turned on the day we lost them both, Mama Tadaba and the accursed parrot, both released by Nathan. What a day that was. For the native members of our household, Independence Day. The bird hung around, casting his vexed eye down on us from the trees, still needing to be fed. The other, she on whom our lives depended, vanished from the village, and the rain poured down, and I wondered, are we lost right now without knowing it? It had already happened so many times in my life, my wedding day comes to mind, that I thought I was out of the woods, not realizing I'd merely paused on the edge of another narrow precipice in the midst of a long, long fall. I can still recite the litany of efforts it took to push a husband and children alive and fed through each day in the Congo. The longest journey always began with sitting up in bed at the rooster's crow, parting the mosquito curtain and slipping on shoes, for there were hookworms lying in wait on the floor, itching to burrow into our bare feet. Shoes, then, sliding me across the floor to greet the day, dreaming of coffee. I'm afraid I didn't miss the physical presence of my husband in his absences as much as I missed coffee. Out the back door, into the shock of damp heat, straining for a look at the river, resisting the urge to run. Oh, that river of wishes, the slippery crocodile dream of it, how it might have carried my body down through all the glittering sandbars to the sea. The hardest work of every day was deciding, once again, to stay with my family. They never even knew. When I pried open the lock meant to keep the beasts and curious children out of our kitchen hut, I nearly had to lock it again behind me to keep myself in. The gloom, the humidity, the permanent sour breath of rainy season all bore down on me like a bothersome lover. The fresh stench of night soil in the bushes, and our own latrine, which was only one step removed. Standing at the work table, I would leave my own thoughts and watch myself murdering oranges with our single, dull knife, slitting their bellies and squeezing out the red blood. But no, first the fruit had to be washed. These strange, so-called blood oranges were gathered wild from the forest. When I bought them from Mama Mokala, I knew they'd passed through the hands of her boys, all of whom bore white crusts on their eyes and penises. Washed then with a drop of precious Clorox bleach, measured out like the blood of the lamb. It's comical, I know, but I carried through those days the image of a popular advertising campaign from home that pictured teams of very soiled children under the bold invocation, Clorox needed here. Very well, then, the juice wrenched from the disinfected skin, and then the pulpy liquid had to be diluted with water if I hoped to make the precious oranges last at all. It's hard to say which cost me more dearly, bleach, oranges, or water. Bleach and oranges both I had to bargain for, or beg for in the case of supplies flown into us by the awful man Eben Axelrod. Every few weeks he turned up without warning, a sudden apparition in rotten boots and sweat-stained fedora, smoking tipperios in my doorway and demanding money for things that were already ours, donated by the Mission League. He even sold us our mail. But then nothing came to us free, not even water. It had to be carried a mile and a half and boiled. Boiled, a small word, meant 20 minutes over a roaring fire on a stove that resembled the rusted carcass of an Oldsmobile. Fire meant gathering up a pile of sticks in a village that had already been gathering firewood for all the years since God was a child, picking its grounds clean of combustibles as efficiently as an animal combing itself for lice. So, fire meant longer and longer forays into the forest, stealing fallen branches from under the blunt-eyed gaze of snakes, just for one single bucket of drinkable water. Every small effort at hygiene was magnified by hours of labor spent procuring the simplest elements, water, heat, anything that might pass for disinfectant. And food,
That was another song and dance. Finding it, learning its name, cutting or pounding or dashing its brains to make it into something my family would tolerate. For a long time, I could not work out how all the other families were getting by. There seemed to be no food to speak of, even on a market day, when everybody came around to make the tallest possible pile out of what they had. It didn't seem to stack up to enough sustenance for the 24 families in our village. Yes, I could see there was charcoal for cooking it, and shriveled red peely peely peppers for spicing it, and calabash bowls to put it in. But where was the it, whatever it was? What on God's earth did they eat? At length I learned the answer, a gluey paste called fufu. It comes from a stupendous tuber, which the women cultivate and dig from the ground, soak in the river, dry in the sun, pound to white powder in hollowed-out logs, and boil. It's called manioc, I was informed by Jana Underdown. It has the nutritional value of a brown paper bag, with the added bonus of trace amounts of cyanide, yet it fills the stomach. It cooks up into the sort of tasteless mass one might induce an American child to try once after a long round of pulled-up noses and double-dog dares. But for the people of Kilanga, fufu was the one thing in life, other than time, that appeared to be taken for granted. There will always be manioc. It is the center of life. When the tall, narrow women, dressed in their sarongs, returned serenely from the fields, they toted it in huge parcels, impossibly balanced on their heads. Manioc root bundles the size of crumpled horses. After soaking and peeling it, they arranged the long white roots into upright sprays in enamel tubs and passed single file through the village, like immense lilies on slender, moving stalks. These women spent their days in the steady labor of planting, digging, and pounding manioc, though the dreamy way they moved through that work made it seem entirely separate from any end product.